Are there any questions before we start discussion of the clustering, which is the next topic? No? Okay. So the next main topic we'll be discussing is the clustering, which is about 1.5 to 2 classes, probably. We mentioned this a lot during the various other classes as to how you could cluster results, you know, in the search engine results to improve, for example, diversity and so on. That's not the only application, but that's one application. And then we more or less actually kind of, if you have done clustering before, some of you may have, then, you know, it might be sort of a rehash, okay? If not, then this will be a, you know, clustering is a general topic that's useful many places, and we would be looking at it from the point of view of text documents, clustering text documents. But the theory isn't all that different if you are clustering text documents as against something else, okay? And then we'll mostly look at some classical algorithms, which are still quite useful, you know, that's basically the scope of the discussion. Before I forget, I should mention that there is going to be this talk, object level search, which is quite relevant to things that we have done. I mean, very probably pretty much a good follow up for the first half of the semester. So if you have time, you know, please show up, right? You know, you'll enjoy it. Okay, that's tomorrow at BY210, which is in the main building in the second floor. Okay, close to the advising office. Okay, so so the idea of clustering, of course, is processing, you know, grouping set of objects which are looking similar, so that hopefully their similarity actually sort of is indication of something that they have in common. Okay, now of course, just because, so for example, here is a class, I can cluster you into groups, okay? I can cluster you in terms of the face color, okay? And I can cluster you in terms of the amount of hair you have. I can cluster you in terms of the color of your t-shirt. I can cluster you in terms of these, all of these being features for each of you, okay? Whether or not the clusters that I made make any sense or not depends on what do I want to do with the cluster. So for example, if I'm trying to put together the best basketball team, right, color of the face might actually be useful, okay? But on the other hand, if I'm talking about, you know, writing the best search engines out there, may or may not be the right thing to, you know, cluster by the some of the other things, okay? Now, the problem, of course, is that you don't quite know upfront what are the relevant features, what are the irrelevant features, and what's the best way to describe distance between objects. Okay, so one of the trade-off, that one of the tension we will be looking at is you could make nice and shiny clusters which have no connection to anything that you are interested in. Do you understand what I'm saying? The easiest way to cluster this class is in terms of nationality. There's an Indian, there's a Chinese, there are a couple of people from Midwest, and that's it, right? But that may be very nice clusters, okay? They look homogeneous. But they may have no connection to what it is that I want to cluster them for, okay? And oftentimes you are clustering before knowing what is the cluster supposed to be used for. This is why clustering is normally called unsupervised learning, where you're just making clusters up and you're hoping that they might wind up being useful in something later, okay? So you're basically, you know, into, you know, you're combining them, objects into classes of similar objects. Now you can say similarity is determined by the distance between the objects or the similarity itself between the objects, but that's just pushing the question one level deeper. How do I define distance between objects, right? You can define it as bag of similarity for documents, but you know how good that is, okay? So the one of the interesting things will be that the biggest impact on clustering algorithms would be the way you define the distances. I mean, in terms of the use of the clusters, would be in terms of the way you define the distances. But in most of our discussion, we'll assume some distance metric is given to us, and then we'll talk about how to, with respect to that distance metric, how to generate clusters. Okay. Okay, so you know, it has lots and lots of applications, and applications in search engines, for example, include structuring the search results, we've been talking about it, suggesting related pages, because if you have clusters, then if you like one page in that cluster, then maybe you'll like the other pages in that cluster. And now, of course, each of these can be done by other techniques, right? I mean, if you want related pages, you don't really need to have a cluster upfront, because you mentioned, we talked about this in the exam. So the simplest thing to do is just take the document itself or some summary of the document as the query and run the query again. It's basically a simple kind of relevance feedback where I told you this is what I like, so I'll get you more of these things. Ignore the query more or less. Okay? So that's the way you can solve this, but you know, if you already have clusters, you can solve this too. And then the other interesting thing, of course, is if you make clusters, then you can actually generate hierarchical clustering, so you can make a directory structure for the world. Okay, remember we showed demos.com, which I used in the topic sensitive page rank, for example. Okay, so the interesting thing about that is that there people were doing this directory construction. We could actually, if we know how to do clustering correctly, then we can actually construct the directory of the universe, you know, for the of the internet ourselves. Okay. And then, you know, other things, you know, lots and lots of other approaches, other useful things. In general, from the point of view of precision recall, it improves recall, okay? It can also improve precision. That's the weird thing, because it can also improve precision because if, in fact, the user is looking for Kalahari Bushmen and you showed the top 10 results about White House Bush, right, your precision has just gone to zero. Whereas if you showed one representative from each cluster, then you have basically captured all possible customers. Okay, the recall improves because once you pick a cluster, you have the other things related to that. That's how the recall is improved. Precision improves because you are making the results diverse to begin with. Okay, so here are some examples. So for example, this, you know, it still remains, this search engine still exists. It's like an example of a clustering based search engine. It's not particularly popular. I don't know what is the kind of traffic it gets, but it's Vivismo basically has this thing called Clusty, and what Clusty does essentially is, it actually, in fact, it's a meta search engine. It calls a bunch of other search engines, takes their top 10 results, so take about 100 or 200 results, and then very quickly do online clustering of them. Okay, and then, so they basically are showing, for example, for a query like Jaguar, Jaguar is actually a kind of a potentially ambiguous query because it could be Jaguar the car, Jaguar the animal, and so what you are basically doing is, and of course, the search engine doesn't know that there are these different ambiguities, just as Bush, you know. Bush query, that is. So in this particular case, it basically is showing you what are all the clusters it has. Now, here is an interesting thing. You have to ask yourself, how did this show? I mean, so first, let's say, here are all the clusters. And when I say I have cluster 15, cluster 95, cluster 875, which one do you want? The people say, what the heck do we know? You know, we don't know what those numbers mean. Okay, so one of the tricky issues is if you have a cluster, you need to provide actually a nice description. From the point of your search engine, you need to provide a description of the cluster that makes sense to the user. Okay, so you can actually, in fact, this would be a nice topic for discussion, you know, on the blog, as to how would you get the terms from the cluster that you're going to show to the user. Essentially, what they wound up doing is they're showing, you know, terms that are appearing frequently in those things, but they also have to take into account IDF. Furthermore, they should take into account IDF not just across all documents, but IDF across other clusters. If this is a word that's appearing more in this cluster and very little in other clusters, then it is actually very much more representative of this particular cluster. Okay, so getting these kind of small descriptions of the cluster is a nice little technical problem in itself. Okay, but that's not too hard. I mean, you almost know how to get that. Okay, so presumably you will get the top K words, you know, that are most frequent words. That's like the dumbest idea that you can come up with. I mean, that's the first idea you can come up with. And then you will say, well, at least consider a TF-IDF metric. And then you can say, well, why do I care about IDF across all documents of the world? What I really want is ICF, inverse cluster frequency. Do you understand what I'm saying? So the words that appear more in this and less in other clusters are obviously much more interesting for, you know, in characterizing this cluster. So you get those and you show these. And then, of course, they might just show I think in this particular case, I can't quite tell whether they are showing one from each of the clusters or they're just showing top 10 results from one of the clusters. Okay. The assumption is that you have these clusters. So if you don't like these results, you can click on one of those clusters and you get many more results. So in some sense, you are cheating. Okay, you're not actually saying these are my results. You're saying these are your results, but then you're also giving this. So if you click on this, you can increase your precision if this is not the Jaguar they are looking for. And in contrast, essentially, Google basically tries to just get the diversity in the page itself without clusters. Okay. Now, I can't quite tell what actually Google does to do that, but, you know, I could guess some ideas. But, you know, one obvious idea is this. You know, if you have clustering, you know, on the results, then picking, you know, representatives from each cluster is a great way of getting, you know, diverse result set. Okay. And then today I actually just ran a Bush query. I mean, a couple of years back. Cluster still exists, and I just ran this before coming to the class and for Bush, and I'm happy to point out that there is an Australian as one of the clusters, which is kind of, I mean, they still didn't catch the Kalahari Bushman, who I really like, but Australian Bushman is the next good example, right? So in essence, of course, you notice that what happened was they took top 200 or so results. In fact, I think, you know, they took top 213 results and then clustered them. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, of course, this is a meta search engine. It actually uses other search engines to call, but you could do this. I mean, and so in some sense, the clustering has to be done online at that time after the query has been presented. So this is a reasonable idea. So if you can get these clusters, so there are two technical problems. One is, how do you identify the clusters? And then, having identified the clusters, how do you give them descriptions that people can understand, other than saying C117, C119, right? Those things don't make sense. The second of them I already sort of answered. You consider the most frequent words that are not present in other clusters. That's the important thing, okay? The first is what basically most of this lecture and, you know, part of next lecture is going to be, which is how to find clusters. Yes, sir. You're talking about here?
No. Google page.
Google page, yeah.
Yeah. You see, the first 5 to 6 results are from Jaguar car.
Uh-huh. Nothing. They could just basically look at which are the bozos who have been looking for Jaguar the query, and if the highest percentage of those people seem to be clicking on Jaguar the car, then Google is better off just showing Jaguar the car results up front. Okay. So
there are these different clusters, like Jaguar the car, Jaguar the animal, then Jaguar the Mac OS.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's, yeah, one way. So I don't understand your question specifically.
So there are these clusters, and you are talking about how to select those clusters basically to represent the...
No, I'm actually showing these clusters to you.
Yeah, but there are like, you know, there will be many clusters and you have to pick some, you know, top key clusters of them.
That's a different point. I mean, you know, I'll just show 10 clusters, which is reasonable number. I mean, if you have a word which has more than 10 senses, then yes, I will miss you, miss making you happy. But search engines miss making most people happy anyway. So just making one guy who insists on asking a word which has, like, I mean, actually the word that has the maximum number of senses, do you know what it is, by the way, in English language? Come on, guys. The F word. The F word has the maximum number of senses. Okay? And, you know, it's considered, I mean, it's considered like, it's like the classic Zipfian distribution, you know. It's like you can use that one word and mean anything you want. And people more or less seem to understand. Okay? Apparently I can't do it in the class. But, you know, if you are searching for that, right, and then you wanted all 1,000 possible, I mean, it's not, I think it's like somebody actually, you know, you can search on the web. I mean, there's like something like 50 to 60 different senses in which you can use the F word. Okay? They're all different senses. Okay, that's a beautiful point. And you know, in those cases, taking just 10 clusters won't be enough. And I'm sure there's like a one single cluster that's dominating that would make most people happy. But that's a different story, right? Yes?
Google's not like page ranking the clusters, right? Like if Jaguar the animal is the most popular page and then Jaguar the car is the second page, that's just how it would appear, right?
I don't understand the question.
Mm-hmm. Putting cars first, or is it that those particular
so all day my assumption is, of course nobody really knows, actually it's not even clear to me what Google does today. I mean, this was last year. Let's look at what Google does now so that okay, so this is what it does. So apparently it changed already.
Yeah.
No, a little bit. Okay. So the point is that there are a bunch of signals that they're using, bunch of features they're going to use, and you know, if you are already logged in, of course the most important features would be descriptions of yourself, okay, that they may have access to. Otherwise they can use things such as of the percentage of people, you know, looking for Jaguar, what percentage of people seem to be happy with Jaguar the car as against Jaguar the Macintosh operating system. My assumption is if for the next month, like the month when Jaguar the operating system came out, you know, it might have ranked higher. Because most people who searched for word Jaguar probably wound up clicking Jaguar the Macintosh operating system. And that can be captured by the search engine. Okay. So rather than, I mean, so they're still trying to basically just give one size fits all, you know, but it's, you know, this, the most number of people are likely to be happy with this. If you're not in the majority, obviously you won't be satisfied. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So, and then there's one more, I guess, here, there, but I think that's much more interesting. These are all other search engines which use different kinds of, clustering ideas, but Clusty is probably currently available and you can play with it and it makes the points clean up. Okay, so that's basically the background of clustering, and the two main the questions are how to make the clusters and how to make cluster representative. By the way, just as I'm saying, I already explained to you what cluster representatives, how cluster representatives are made, that is just take the most, you know, frequent words which have the highest ICF, inverse cluster frequency, also, okay, and then make them the description of this cluster, right? A related question that I did not ask, that I did not ever discuss in the class is when you find a page, you need to provide a little synopsis to the user, right? In fact, all of them do this, right? If you look at, not only do you say just Jaguar, but you sort of give some sort of a description of that site. Right? So the description of the site, how do you make that happen? Again, you know, you can't just give the, you know, the worst thing that you can do, and that's probably what you did. How many of you in the first project just gave the raw URLs as the results? Yeah, that's the easy thing to do, but if if some search engine did to you, you would hate it. What does the URL mean? You need a description of the URL. And the description of the URL, what part of the description is relevant? There's an interesting question, right? So in fact, one idea, of course, one simple idea you can see is find the places where the query words are appearing and take the window around them. You know, 5 words before, 5 words after. And point at least that out. Okay, the first mention of the words that you are searching for in your file, and then take, you know, 5+5 window around them, and then just show those chunks of the sentences. That's not too hard. You know, you have all the information in front of you, so you can actually pick that up. Okay, that's one way. Okay, notice, of course, that would mean that the synopsis is made at the query time. The same page will have different synopsis based on the query you are asking. But then there is also a synopsis for a page that's just independent of the queries, the best description, best top-level description of the page. Right? So that too is allowed. So for example, let me see. Okay, see, that's the description apparently of me, right? And irrespective of, so this is like the top level description of my page, and if you say Kanur, that's his top level description. Kanur, by the way, is Donald Kanur. How many of you don't know Kanur's name? You should, okay. If you're in computer science, you should know Kanur's name. And so that's his top level description. Now the question, of course, is how do you figure out the top level descriptions of pages? It turns out there is no easy way of finding out top level summary of pages. Okay, what you do is if you put an alt meta tag in your page and write something there, basically search engine, especially Google, just picks that up and makes that your top level description of your page. Okay, so the way I got the previous version out is my page has that version, because if you go to my page and look at the source, then there is an alt meta tag. And that's more or less directly believed. Okay, what's cute is, this is not directly relevant, but what's cute is if you go to Don Kanut's homepage and look at his source of the page, this part doesn't exist anywhere on the page. Okay, that's because Larry and Sergey just wrote this for him. So they, you know, there are some few people in the world for whom they have given the top level description. Okay, and so that's one of them. So that's cute. But on the other hand, you too can say the best basketball player in the world, and at least for 3 days you can be seen that way by just changing your alt meta tag. Okay, so that's one thing. But that's the query independent part. Query dependent part, when the query is given, you have the words and you look at the 5+5 around the area. Okay, so there are interesting technique, you know, issues in generating synopsis for the pages. And especially the query dependent part, you have to understand that it has to be done online, and so it has to be done very fast. Okay, you have to think about how you can use the existing indexing structure to make that up. Okay? In fact, one thing you can see is I can't just ask what are the words, you know, if this word is appearing in 45th position, do I have an easy way of finding out what are the words appearing in 44th and 43rd and 46th and 47th position? Not in the inverted index. You need the forward index. Okay? And if you want to do things fast, you need to have lots of indexes. Okay, that's like the big deal. So, for example, even when you're typing these words, right, as you're typing the words, you have a completion, right? Okay, the completion. Now, how does that completion work? It's easy enough. Basically, you have a huge query log, and you're very quickly figuring out which are the words that are going to be completed you know, which are going to be, you know, starting with these sentence, with these words or with these strings. Okay, nothing particularly hard, but you have to do it in sub real time. So you need to have an extremely good index. Okay, such that you can, you know, figure out you know, the words that appear next to each other in the query log. Okay, this is of course with respect to the query log, by the way. This whole thing is with respect to the query log. Okay, so finding synopsis for pages is similar to finding synopsis for clusters, and both of which I only discuss in brief, and then we'll move on. Okay. So the clustering issues in general are, so we'll just do most of the discussion, some of the discussion at least, in terms of just vectors in high dimensions. Okay, and text documents are vectors in high dimensions, right? So you can think of the, you know, here are, you know, vectors in two dimensions, points in two dimensions, and I want to find some clusters for this. Okay, so the question of course is, I mean, of course many of you will say, oh, this is one cluster, that's one cluster. It's a reasonable thing to say. Whether or not that's right is anybody's guess. Okay, so some of the issues you would have to think about are, to even talk about clusters, you need to talk about distances between the points. Okay, so remember that some real world entity has already been put in this two dimensional vector form. Once you put it in this form, then the distances, the most reasonable distances to talk about, are the Euclidean distances. But what if you actually put it in the wrong form, in the sense the least important two dimensions are these? In which case you are finding the wrong distances between things. Okay? So we will ignore that point and we'll assume that, you know, somebody already picked the right features and all you are assuming is some distance measure between the points. Okay. And all we care about a distance measure is that it satisfies the triangle loss inequality. That's a useful thing to have. Okay? So, and then hard versus soft clusters. So if you're trying to find clusters, are you talking about hard clusters in the sense that everything is only in one cluster at most? Or do you also allow some things to be present 90% in this cluster, 10% in the other cluster? Those are soft clusters. Okay? And then also exhaustive versus inexhaustive clustering. Exhaustive clustering means everything has to be put in some cluster or other. Inexhaustive basically means there are some outliers, I don't want to cluster them at all. So for example, here I have this, this, and then a point like say right there. And then I'm trying to look for two clusters here. What do I do? Or in fact, if I don't know how many clusters to look for, then there is this outlier and you can say it's a cluster by itself. That's like the most reasonable thing to do. Okay, and that's the question of ignoring some points. You would not cluster them at all. You don't give them any label at all. Okay, that's something that you have to see, you know, during the clustering. Okay, and then the question is, if you do come up with the clusters, how do you evaluate them? What do you say? If you have one clustering algorithm, somebody else has another clustering algorithm, how do you evaluate the clusters? Okay, there are two ways of evaluating clusters. One is internal measure, how self-consistent are the clusters themselves. Okay, a cluster is a good cluster if it's sort of nice, tight-knit community. Okay, that basically means the distance between any pair of things in a cluster is significantly smaller than distance between one thing in one cluster and another thing in another cluster. That's a useful thing to talk about. So intra-cluster distances are much smaller than inter-cluster distances. That looks like a reasonable thing to say, except sometimes, you know, suppose I have clusters like this, let's say. That's one cluster, that's another cluster, right? Clearly in this kind of a cluster, I could have this kind of cluster, depending on my actual semantics. In that kind of cluster, this guy is closer to this guy. I mean, Arizona is really closer to Mexico than it is to Washington, D.C., in case you haven't figured it out till now, right? And we are still clusters. Supposedly, we are in one cluster, they are in another cluster, right? How did we decide? How do we make sure that? So it turns out that depending on the way, one of the most interesting things is that depending on the way you define distance between clusters, you're likely to get either spherical clusters are elongated clusters. So if for example I gave you two clusters and then I say define a distance between these clusters, how do you define them? You could say define the distance to be the distance between the centroids. Okay? Or you could say define the distance to be the distance between the closest two entities in the two clusters. And depending on the way you define that distance, and then depending on what you're trying to, normally when you're doing clustering, you want to increase the distance between the clusters. Right? So you would wind up getting different kinds of clusters based on the way you define the clusters. Yes?
Is it possible those two put together could also be representative of each cluster?
What?
They'll be that close, cluster representative.
That's basically the point of soft clusters. If you are part of both, you are 80% part of this cluster, 20% part of that cluster, then that would be a soft clustering. So that means each element has membership in multiple clusters. Okay? So and then the external measures essentially make no sense. If you actually say that clustering is being done without knowing what it is being used for, which is unsupervised learning, then you can't really have an external measure. Okay? Normally what happens is that there are situations where you know what are the real clusters, and then you let your clustering algorithm run on it and see how close it comes to actually capturing what you have in mind. Okay? So for example, if all I'm interested in is differentiating George Bush pages from Kalahari Bushman pages, then I care about whether or not my clustering algorithm was able to make that differentiation. That's all. Because I can tell by reading the page whether it is, you know, George Bush page or Kalahari Bushman page. Okay? Notice, however, that that's only my thing. I am crazy about differentiating these two. Okay? But for some other person, probably they didn't care. I mean, that's not the most important distinction they wanted to make. Okay? So if you do have an external measure, you can use, you know, you can compare the clusters you made with respect to the external clusters that are actually present. Okay, and it's an interesting way, there are some interesting issues, we'll look at that in a minute. Okay, so for the internal measures, basically you can agree with these without too much conflict. So intra-cluster distance, you know, is basically the distance between the objects in the same cluster. Whichever way you define that, okay, now there are many pairs of objects in the cluster, okay? Now you need to take all these pairs of distances and make a single number, okay? You can make it one way, which is you take the maximum distance between the any two elements in the cluster. You can minimize that. Or you can say sum of all the distances, or sum of the squares of all the distances, and you can minimize that too. Okay, depending on the way you describe, you know, exactly what intra-cluster distance is, the clusters that you get will be slightly different. But we all will agree that whatever is an intra-cluster distance measure, you want to minimize it. And similarly, whatever is the inter-cluster distance measure, you want to maximize it. Now, of course, again, just as intra-cluster distance can be defined in multiple ways based on either taking the maximum distance between any two points in the cluster, or the average distance between any two points in the cluster, or the sum of the distances between any two points in the cluster, and each of these has their own problems. Okay? You could have, they're all sort of distances about things in a single cluster. And similarly here, you can talk about distance between the centroids, are distances, some of the pairwise distances between one point from here and one point from here. That's another way you can do it. So take point A here, point B here, take that distance, square it, add that to point A, point C, add that to point C, point D, and so on. That's another way of describing. Okay. Now, and then of course the objective to minimize is some function of intra and inter-cluster distances. And you want the function potentially tries to, if at all it's doing something to the intra-cluster distance, it's trying to minimize it, reduce it. And if at all it's trying to do inter-cluster distance, it's trying to maximize it. Okay? And you know, some of the measures we'll look at would ignore one of them completely. and just look at one thing, for example. In fact, the one that we will talk in the very beginning, called k-means clustering, essentially just ignores the inter-cluster distances and only cares about making individual clusters as tight as possible. Okay. And then that's the internal measure. The external measures, they are related to how representative the clusters are to the actual true clusters that you have in mind. Okay. You may not be representative of the entire world, but as long as you are just trying to see whether the kind of clustering you want to do is being captured by the algorithm and the distance measure you have, you can compare them. Okay. And the way you could do it is, for example, suppose the thing that you really care about is the color. That's what you have in mind. Okay. So you wanted to get all the red ones together, all the blue ones together, all the green ones together. That's what you really want to do. And your algorithm came up with these three clusters. Okay. Then what I can do is that, so this is cluster 1, cluster 2, cluster 3, and then you can talk about the notion of the purity of the cluster. It's not important that cluster 1 should be green, cluster 2 should be blue, cluster 3 should be red. It doesn't matter. All I want is one of them should be specializing in red, one should be specializing in green, one should be specializing in blue. Okay, so I can talk about the purity of the cluster, which is take this cluster, take its majority color, divide it by its size. If that's one, that means basically it only has that color, nothing else. Okay, so in fact, I'm talking about color, but really what I'm talking about, what I should talk about is class labels. So there are three class labels, okay, and I want to put red class labels together, blue class labels together, and green class labels together. Okay, and my system doesn't know what classes I'm actually trying to cluster. So it did whatever it did based on the distance measure I supplied it. Then I can say how pure is its clustering with respect to what I want it to do. Okay, and so in this particular case, the 1 over 6 of maximum of, for the cluster 1, 5 red ones, 1 blue one, and 0 green ones. So majority is the red one. So it really is sort of a red state, red cluster. Okay, but its purity is over 5 over 6, this guy's purity is 4 over 6, this guy's purity is 3 over 5. Okay, and so if these are a very good clusters, then all of the clusters will have purity 1. Okay, and furthermore, in fact, you can actually, if you want one single measure for this, you can also talk about weighted purity measure, which is the size of each cluster times its purity. Okay, yes. No, all I am saying is that we don't really know what this guy was looking for when they made this cluster. But as far as I'm concerned, since I look for redness, okay, so here's, you know, we don't really know why people pick Obama versus McCain for voting. They could be doing it for age reasons, they could be doing it for, you know, race reasons, they could be doing it for the hair reasons, all sorts of things. Right? But what we want to look is we look at a state like Arizona and say it's a red state. Because based on the poll, it seems like most people are going for McCain. And we don't really care about what their reasoning was. They use their own reasons to come up with their cluster. And I know that what I want to do clustering with respect to is how many people are going Republican, how many people are going Democrat. Okay? That's the same thing I'm doing here, which is we don't quite know why this clustering algorithm came up with this cluster. But if I look at it, I say that's a red cluster because it has majority red in it. You could have one more cluster that's also majority red. That's fine. Okay. Now, this is just an idea that I'm giving you. In fact, you know, one way, by the way, you know, can somebody think of an easy way to get high purity? Singleton cluster. You know, in fact, keep that in mind. You know, clusters of size 1 are great. You know, they're pure. Okay, they're useless, but they're pure. Okay, and we'll see that, in fact, the singleton clusters come up again, too. Okay, so you have to make, this thing makes sense if, in fact, you restricted the number of clusters already. And you said you have to come up with 3 clusters or 5 clusters. Now this is a tricky issue. Which is more reasonable problem? Do you normally know how many clusters are supposed to be there? Sometimes you know, sometimes you don't. Like for example, I know as far as elections are concerned, there should only be 2 clusters. Now I'm going to correct your midterm exam and I'm going to use clustering to figure out who should get A, who should get B, etc. Is that a case where I know the number of clusters? Yes. You know, I know the maximum number of clusters. There's an A plus, A minus, B plus, B, B minus, etc. I can just give, you know, those many clusters and find all possible ways of clustering them into those many clusters and see whichever has the best metric. Okay? In some cases, you know the number of clusters, in which case it makes sense. And in some cases, you don't know the number of clusters, and that's much more interesting because if you don't know the number of clusters, there is a degenerate way of making most reasonable metrics on cluster purity, cluster goodness be high, but without having any use for that measure, which is to make everybody be a cluster by themselves. Okay, just keep that in the back of your mind. So in this case, I'm assuming that I told already that I'm going to ask for 3 clusters, and then I'm doing this. It's not so much that really, well, okay, so let's assume that in this case, I'm looking for 3 clusters, and I'm compared how those clusters actually correspond to what I'm trying to separate. Okay. Here is another way of looking at the same thing. So these are, by the way, what do these measures look like? This purity measure is sort of related to precision and recall measures. And the next one makes it even more clear. Okay? So here is basically what I want. Okay, in the given the points, so for each point, you know their actual, if I give, so I know the points, for all of these points, I know what their actual cluster label is. This guy's label is red, this guy's label is blue, because I know this, my system doesn't know it. And this guy's label is green. Okay, now each of these are numbered, okay, let's say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, etc. 1 is supposed to have label red, and 2, 3 is also supposed to have label red. Okay, 1 and 3 are supposed to have the same label, and they are actually in the same cluster. That's good. Okay, here is another guy who has the label red. He's supposed to be in the same cluster with the red guys, but he's in a different cluster. That's bad. So this cluster, even though it's a red cluster, its recall is not full because it's not recalling all the red guys. Do you see what I'm saying? So that's what this thing is doing. It's another way of counting the mismatches. So for example, same cluster in the clustering, different clusters in the clustering, and same class in the ground truth, different classes in the ground truth for each pair of objects. Okay, take, you know, if you have n objects, then you have n square pairs, n square by 2 pairs, and for each pair of objects, you consider whether they are supposed to be in the same cluster. And if so, are they actually put in the same cluster? Okay, and you can have all these 4 following things. The best is they're supposed to be in the same cluster according to the ground truth, and your clustering algorithm put them together. Okay, and then this one is actually, they're supposed to be in the same cluster, but your clustering algorithm put in different clusters. That's like this red and this red. Okay, and similarly here, they're supposed to be in the different clusters, but your clustering algorithm put in the same cluster. That's like this red and this blue. Okay? And then this one is different clusters in clustering, but they're supposed to be also in the different clusters. So these two are good guys. The green ones are good guys. You separated unlike guys into different clusters, put the like guys into the same cluster. And these other guys are basically the mix-ups. Either you missed with respect to the ground truth or missed with respect to the actual clustering. Okay, so I can talk about precision is A by A plus B, and the recall is A by A plus C. So these are the numbers. And then I can differentiate, you know, there's a measure, I think called RAND index measure, which basically just does A plus B by A plus B plus C plus C. which sort of takes all of them into account together. Okay, so you are, just as precision recall measures were described with respect to an external reality. Remember, somebody else actually tells you what is really relevant, and then you compare what the search engine did to that. Okay, here too, the external measures are being done by comparing what the clustering came up with to what the external reality was. Now, this one actually is the interesting thing, is does it tell you how many clusters things are supposed to be put in? No. It's okay with me if you made two red clusters, as long as they're just purely red. Actually, no. In fact, that's not true. I'm sorry. It does, because if there are two red guys, wait, let me think. Yeah, you can keep them separately, because what happens is, there is a problem. So in this particular case, let's see, these two red guys, they're in the same cluster, so you won't get any penalty because of them. But this red guy and this red guy, they are in different clusters, so you get penalty from them. Okay? So that's basically another way of describing, comparing the clustering, the clusters you made to the external reality. Okay. Yes, sir. D will be, yeah, no, number of clusters is, yeah, so what's the point?
So the point is, so when we compute the run index, so because D is very big, so it may be close to 1.
Yeah. So, but that's assuming that you actually are getting as many clusters as there are points. But that's a degenerate case anyway. Okay, so both this measure and this measure are meant to be some ways in which you can think about evaluating clusters. They have problems, in particular when you wind up having, degenerate cases, where in fact the number of clusters is as big as the number of points. Okay, but it's a good point. I'm not putting my entire force behind this. There are many, many ways of comparing clusters to ground reality, and these are two that I gave you. Yes, sir. Yeah, that's what I meant. But that's a degenerate case. And then what happens in the degenerate case? Because basically, the point, of course, is in the degenerate case, the point that he's making is, notice what you're saying, which is that if the ground truth, they are supposed to be completely, that means I am really comparing, 1 million completely different fruits. They have nothing in common between each other. Not just apples and oranges. Apples, oranges, plums, pears, and all of them are completely different. There are no two apples there at all. So the ground truth actually requires that there are as many clusters as there are points. In that case, the right thing to do would be to put them in n different clusters. That's the only time, okay? But that's one time where you shouldn't really be looking for clusters. I mean, if you had any idea that the world is that way, then you shouldn't be looking for clusters. Okay? But do think about, some of these issues as to, how the clusters that exist in the world, sometimes you know how many clusters actually exist in the world. And then what the clustering algorithm does and how to compare them. More often than not, you have no clue how many clusters actually exist in the world. That's why this is unsupervised learning, normally. Now, I keep saying unsupervised learning, but the issue is sometimes you might know in the clustering that so supervised versus unsupervised, the difference is in the supervised learning, you get given a bunch of training examples and their labels. Okay, had I given you these guys and their labels up front, and then all you're supposed to learn is, given a new red point, say that it's red. Given a new blue point, say it's a blue. That would be classification or the supervised learning. Okay, normally in this case, in the unsupervised case, you don't know what the labels are for each of the points. It could be as many labels as the number of points, or it could be just one label for all the points. It can be anywhere in between. You have no clue. You, the clustering algorithm. That's why it's called unsupervised. So you're just hoping that syntactic distance measures between the entities might correspond to some notion of actual semantic clusters that exist in the data. Yes, sir.
Is it better than supervised learning? As in, you know, problems like outlier problems?
No. If you have a chance to either solve, if your life can be either supervised learning or unsupervised learning, and I ask you to pick, never pick unsupervised learning. Makes no sense, right? If I tell you, I mean, if I'm not an adversarial teacher, okay, and if I'm going to tell you, you know, here are the data points and here are their labels, it's a much simpler learning problem. They're not knowing the labels, okay? But the point is, many a time we are stuck with having to do unsupervised learning because nobody, there is no teacher who is giving you the labels.
The samples are not so representative?
No, there are no labels at all. There are no labels at all. So, for example, here is a bunch of people. You know, what are their labels? I don't have any labels. Okay? And I'm trying to still cluster them into groups. My hope is that by clustering them, I might be able to do my performance later better. That's exactly what the search engines were doing. They had no clue that, in fact, people who are looking for Kalahari Bushmen would be different from the people who are looking for White House Bush. The search engine doesn't have a clue. They're just assuming that's the case. Why, you know, for example, they could also have clustered in such a way that pages which have 1 to 100 words are in one cluster, 100 to 300 words on a different cluster, 300 to 800 words on a different cluster. That would be a clustering too, and you can do that clustering. It's just a useless clustering because most people, you know, wind up not, you know, there may be people who actually care about that, okay, but most people don't seem to care about it. Okay, so part of this is that we are acting this unsupervised, we are trying to straddle in both ways. One is we are saying it's unsupervised in the sense there is actually no information about the labels. But on the other hand, sometimes you do have some information, okay? You may not know, for example, these are red, these are blue, these are green as the labels, but you may know that, look, you know, find some grouping of these kids, right? But this person and this person, they just can't get along well, okay? And those two other kids, look, they're already holding on to each other, so they probably want to go into the same cluster together. Now find a grouping. This is more or less what happens when you're making, you know, sports teams, right, in at least grade school. You know, the friends, the pairs of friends, the groups of friends try to get into one team together. Okay? There, all you're saying is there are local constraints as to, we don't quite know what clusters they're supposed to be correctly in, but I might say that, look, these two points want to be in the same cluster. These two points don't want to be in the same cluster. If I give you that information, I'm giving you partial information about the reality. And so clusters which are consistent with those constraints are likely to be better when finally evaluated by these kind of measures than clusters that are not consistent with those constraints. Okay, so although we will look at clustering as unsupervised mostly, it's really a spectrum, where sometimes you can wind up saying that, you know, there is some partial knowledge about what things might be in the same cluster without knowing exactly what defines a cluster, which means without knowing for every training example what its label is, you may still know that certain things go together, certain things cannot go together. This is like the GRE analytical kind of questions where they'll, you know, give partial information, and sometimes that might give you enough global information. Sometimes at least it will constrain the kinds of clusters you will make. Okay, so for the text clustering, if this is how we did this with respect to general vectors, you know, in high dimensions, for the text clustering, you could do clustering can be done any time. You can do it in the indexing time, and so that would sort of be making, you know, clustering of the entire document into like a directory structure, like the Yahoo directory, for example. You can do it at the query time, which is what Clusty is doing, for example. Okay. Now, clustering can be based on a distance. It has to be based on a distance measure. Okay. And the distance measure can be based on, for example, some of these features. So they can be based on text content, which you already right away see. right? Because, you know, you can take two text documents and compute their vector similarity. That would be a distance. Okay, but it might also be based on if in fact what I'm trying to find are clusters of people who seem to be colluding together to do things on the web. Like, for example, the quote-unquote terrorist networks. They're not going to write Al-Qaeda or something 58 times on their page. In fact, people like me wind up writing those things, okay? But they won't write. So what you are then looking at is the link structure of the pages. And so you have to define distances based on the link structure. And sometimes you may have to define distances based on all of them together. Okay, but all I'm saying is distances can be dependent on the URL name, the text content, as well as links in the case of text documents, because those are the only things that we actually have available in terms of syntactic features. Okay? Now, the next thing we want to talk about is to define the inter and intra-cluster distances, because remember that if you're trying to generate a clustering algorithm, okay, the thing that matters is not these two, because these two are after the clustering is over, you're just comparing it to what you really wished happened, but were not ready to give it beforehand. Do you understand what I'm saying? So unsupervised learning is I just, you know, as you come into the class, in the first day of the class, I'll give you the final exam. And then if you do well, I say, yeah, you did well. If you didn't do well, I say, you're a loser. Okay? Supervised learning is such as it is, I'm supposedly trying to teach you what would come on the exam, and the homeworks are supposedly giving you what kind of questions you have to look at, and then there is an exam, and then you will be tested. Okay? So you cannot generalize. So the thing that matters in the unsupervised learning case, you cannot look at these and try to maximize the performance with respect to these, because this information is not available at the time you are generating the algorithm. Do you understand that? You can't optimize your performance with respect to a measure that for which the information is not available upfront for you. Okay. So what I will instead look at is internal cluster improves, internal cluster measure, intra-cluster purity measure. These don't have to have anything to do with this. All this is saying is my clusters are nice and shiny. They're nice and circular. But they may be wrong clusters with respect to somebody's interest in actually defining the labels. But this is the best you can do. Okay? So remember that I talked about intra-cluster and inter-cluster distance as the measures, and I have to minimize some function of them. Okay? So what would be the intra-cluster distance? It would be, you know, essentially given a particular cluster, then there are pairs of points, and then you can consider for every pair of points, what's the distance within that cluster? Or you can take the centroid and the distance of that point from the centroid. So all you're saying is sum or minimum or maximum average of the absolute or squared distance between either all pairs of points in the cluster, or between the centroid and all the other points in the cluster, or between the medoid, which is the median of the cluster. Okay, and all other points in the cluster. I can define my distance in any which of these ways. And depending on the way I define, I have to write the algorithm such that it respects that distance measurement. Okay, and similarly, inter-cluster distance is either the sum of the squared distance between all pairs of clusters. That much is for sure. Okay, basically, I want to keep all clusters away from each other. Okay, now the question, of course, is how do you define the distance between two clusters? And given two clusters, you can define their distance as the distance between their centroids or medoids. You can define the distance between the closest pair of points belonging to the closest pair of points belonging to two different clusters. So, for example, this and this. Okay, and you can also define it, and then you can also define it as farthest pair of points in the two clusters. Okay, so in this particular case, the distance between them will be from here to here then. Okay, now if you were to define distances this way, then you are likely to get chain-shaped clusters, if the data allows it. Whereas if you define clusters based on the farthest points being far away from each other, then you are likely to get spherical clusters which are far enough from each other. Okay, because remember, ultimately, you have a bunch of points And I can make a cluster like this, right? Or I can make a cluster like this. The green one is a clustering, so is the blue one. Which is the right one? We have no clue. But which one will I get depends on how I define the distances. Okay? Let me see if I can show you that one picture, for example. Okay, let's see. Consider these points. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Right? And here are two ways of clustering them. Okay, now can you tell me which of them, so here is one way of clustering them, the black, and here is the red way of clustering them. Can you tell me which of these clusters are likely to come for which of these distance measures? Think about it, okay? That's something that we'll again talk about, but you know, you should at least figure that out as to the fact that the way you define the distance measures might wind up changing the clusters you get. Now, which is the right one depends on the ground reality. I have no clue about that. But what I will get depends on how I define these distances, which distances I went with. So sometimes if I know, for example, that in the world I live in there are spherical clusters, and then I know that if I define intercluster distance this way, I'm likely to get chain clusters, then I avoid defining it this way. So I'm using the partial information about the world to pick the right distance measure up front. Okay, so notice that by the time you came here, you already defined distance between any two points, which is a huge decision. That was what we were talking about here. Should it be based only on text? Should it be based on URL and text? Should be based on URL, text, and the link. All of those you decided up front. But having done that, there are still choices as to how to define the intercluster and intracluster distances. So how hard is clustering? So obviously, if you know the number of clusters that can be present, n clusters, let's say, okay, and there are k points, there are k clusters and there are n points, okay, each point, and assume it's a exhaustive clustering, that means everybody can only be in one cluster and everybody should be in some cluster, then there are k power n ways of putting these into clusters, except order doesn't matter, so you divide it by k factorial. That's the number of clusters. K power n by k factorial is the number of potential clusterings that you can do. Then what you can do is for generate each of these clusterings and then compare them in terms of, since the only thing you can do is internal measure of cluster goodness, which is based on intra-cluster and inter-cluster distances. The simple way is you can just add them up, for example, or you can say square one and square the other, add them up. So you can compare each of these clusterings on those measures, and whichever wins, you take that. That's the brute force measure. Okay? But obviously, it's going to be too many clusterings. So what you normally do is you try to find the cluster sort of iterative way, greedily. Okay? Sometimes you do actually write an optimization algorithm which tries to optimize the specific distance measure you're trying to minimize. Okay? And then either solve it actually exactly or just approximate that. But in the class, we will essentially look at the greedy methods mostly. Okay. Before we leave, and we have actually, so the kind of thing, there are multiple ways of generating these clusters. So there are these many clusters. If you know that the k clusters is what I'm looking for, this in itself is a special case. Sometimes you don't know how many clusters are there. Okay. One problem with knowing that there are k clusters is if I want k clusters, you will find k clusters. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's like there is this thing that I once heard that. So there are basically two kinds of people in the world, one who say basically and other who don't say basically. Okay? It's a kind of a recursive definition. If I decide to make the world into two kinds, I will find two kinds. If I want to make it into five kinds, I will find five kinds. The question is really how many clusters are there? I don't know. Okay? A simpler case would be assuming that you know the number of clusters, and even in that case, the number of cluster rings is too many, and you have to compare clusterings to find the best clustering with respect to the internal measure, which may have nothing to do with the external measure. But you're supposed not to have anything to do with the external measure because you're not supposed to know. It's unsupervised learning. Okay, so the way you can generate clusterings would be partitioning methods where you sort of take all the points, okay, split them into k clusters, let's say. Okay, and then keep changing the clusters until they become nice and shiny, where we'll describe what nice and shiny is in a minute. Okay, the other is hierarchical methods where you build clusters bottom up. You start saying, okay, these two points seem to be happy, put them together. These two points seem to be happy, put them together. Now these two and these two are already part of this thing, so now they're actually two-sized clusters. They are very close, so I will combine them. Now notice that in the hierarchical methods, in the very beginning, in the bottom, I have to decide what is the distance between real points. But having combined this and combined this, now to decide, and so in fact this is the answer in some sense for that problem I asked you to think about. In that four problem, you have, after the first step, you will get these two close, these two close, these two close, these two close. So now I have, you know, clusters, here I have four points, but they're really clusters. And I have to decide which of them are closer. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now if I define distance in terms of the single link, which is the closest pair of points, then I would have combined these together and these together, because this distance is smaller than this distance. If I define the distance based on the farthest two points in the cluster, then I would have said these two are too far from each other, but these two are closer, because the farthest distance is still this, actually this. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that's where the inter-cluster distance directly comes into play in hierarchical methods. So the answer for the problem that I actually think about, I actually gave here, but you also see why it is connected in terms of cluster distance definition, because after the first iteration is over, you're really comparing clusters, which became points. Okay? So the first one we'll talk about is a partitioning method called k-means, which is a cute algorithm. I think I will be able to explain that to you in 5 minutes, and then we'll talk more about all sorts of variations of it when we come back next class. Okay? All you do in k-means is very simple. The way I think about it is the way you go into a class of kids and say, guys, make yourself into four groups. Okay? And normally what happens, four kids stand up and say, we want to make groups. Okay? And then everybody in the class then suddenly runs towards their friend, whoever is running the group. So now you have four groups. Okay? Having joined a group, right, because the leader of the group looked like you like them, you realize that the rest of the bozos in the group, you hate them. Okay? So this is not the kind of group you wanted to be in. Whereas this other group, the leader isn't as nice to you, but all your other friends joined that group. So you say, hey, you know, I don't want to be here. I'll move there. And some of those people move there. Second iteration. And a few more iterations later, everybody is happy where they are. Or the teacher says stop. Okay? And you have four groups. That's k-means. That's completely k-means. Okay? So all you need is, given a bunch of points, you essentially find, if you want k leaders, I mean k clusters, you need k centroids, centers of each of the clusters. We don't quite know what are the centroids. Pick any k points randomly. And then every point then goes into, so these, each of these k points define one of the clusters. Every other point, other than these k points, says, I am going to go to the guy, the cluster whose centroid is closest to me. So they make independent decisions, decentrally, decentralized fashion. Just look at the centroid, look at my distance from the centroid, and say, I'm in this cluster. Okay? And then at this point, now you actually see the cluster. Previously, this bozo said they were the leader, but now you see the cluster, so you know the real centroid of the cluster. So you compute the real centroid of the cluster, And then those may not actually correspond to anybody in the group, any real entity in the group. It's a centroid, it's just an arbitrary point which is just, x1 plus x2, etc. by number of points, y1 plus y2, etc. by number of points, and so on. And then you essentially compare your distance to those centroids, everybody, and then changes their position. Here is a little picture. Okay? So this is my previous example, right? So all I need is, I want k means it's k equal to 2. So I want two groups in this. So let me take I'm making my life hard, and I'm basically, the two people who wanted to be the leaders are both from something that you would think are in one cluster. Do you agree with me, right? If you look at this. So this red and blue want to be the guys, okay? So now all the points, find out their distances from them, and then all these red points are actually closer to that guy, and all these blue points are closer to this guy. Okay? Next thing, now you actually take all these red points and compute the centroid for the redness, which is this. This is not a real person. This is not a real point. But this is where the centroid is. And the blue centroid is here. So now everybody does that decision again. Okay? What do you think will happen at this point? Clearly all these red guys think, hey, look, we are actually farther from this guy than this, so I'm going to join this. And then there is no more people changing after this, so you stop. That's it. That's k-means. Okay? And you can point out that if you were to define, so now what is k-means minimizing? It's getting there. It is getting to a fixed point. You will get to a fixed point. Okay? There are all sorts of problems with this. We'll talk about next class. But it's a beautiful algorithm. It runs. Okay? The question is, what exactly is it minimizing? If you consider the goodness of each cluster as the tightness, you already know the number of clusters. Okay? So all you are really going to look at is how nice and shiny is each cluster. And you can define the goodness of each cluster, let's say, in terms of the squares of the distances between the point, every point, and the centroid of that cluster. And you sum them up. This number is going to reduce monotonically as you go from iteration to iteration. That's basically what it's doing. Okay. Now the problem, of course, is k-means can get stuck. K-means can get stuck in local minimum. And in fact, it can depend on, even though I gave you this nice example where it looked as if I started with two bad leaders and still the natural clustering occurred, it doesn't have to occur that way. The number of iterations that are taken as well as the actual clusters you come up with, and the lowest value those clusters, internal distance measures reach would depend on the initial cluster seeds. Now this is exactly what Nader and Ralph Nader and what's the other guy? Bob Barr and who else? Do you know who I'm talking about, by the way? These are the other guys, the other presidential candidates. They're saying these two bozos stood up and they are not really representative of, it's not the right way to find clusters in US apparently is not Republicans versus Democrats, according to Bob Barr and what's his name, right? And they're saying because you've started with the wrong leaders and you just have to coalesce around them, you will coalesce around them, but you would not have reached the optimal configuration. Whereas had you coalesced between Bob Barr and Nader, you may have gotten better clustering. You'll never know. You can let them run the country for a couple of minutes and then see what happens. But the interesting point is that the initial seeds do have an impact on how far you can go down. Okay? And so you will try to find reasonable seeds up front, and then we'll talk about methods which will basically come up with reasonable seeds to begin with, and then that will reduce the number of iterations as well as find you the k number of clusters. The last question is this. Suppose I don't know the number of clusters that I'm trying to find, right? What can I do? What I can do is the following. I can keep increasing the number of clusters. So first look for the k equal to 2. See what is the distance measure, that aggregate distance measure. Then increase it to k equal to 3. See the distance measure. Increase it to k equal to 4. See the distance measure. And wherever it becomes the smallest, stop. How many of you think that's a reasonable idea? It's the end of the class, but still. Where will it end? It will end with k equal to n, where everybody is extremely happy because they are the centroid. So the distance of them to the centroid is 0. So k equal to n is exactly where it becomes minimum. So what you really have to do is, you know that if you increase the number of clusters, ultimately when the number of clusters becomes equal to the number of points, the distance measure is equal to 0. However, you can see the way the thing is reducing and look for knees. That is a point up to which you are coming falling faster and then you start falling slower. Okay, in this particular case, this is a good knee. 4 is a reasonable number. So is like 9. Okay, but looking for, you know, if you just keep increasing, then you will get 0, which is not good. Because when you got 0, then you have as many clusters as the number of points. We'll think more about this next class when we come, and then we'll also talk about hierarchical clustering, and then that will be the end of the class.